The Guardian.
Hello and welcome to Tech Weekly from The Guardian. I'm Alex Kratosky, and joining me this week is Juliet Garside, The Guardian's communications correspondent. Welcome, Juliet, to the studio.
Hello, thanks for having me.
You're very welcome. Now, you've been with The Guardian for about a month now.
That's right, yes.
And tell me what your beat is.
I cover telecoms for the business desks. I'm looking not so much at what a mobile phone handset can do, but what the industry is doing with mobile phone handsets.
Ah, that's very important at the minute.
Yes, I think mobile communications have become more exciting than they have been in years, and what happened yesterday only adds to the excitement.
Why do you think that is? Why do you think it has become more interesting?
Well, I think for years, mobile companies were struggling to get anyone to use the internet on their phones. Apple came along, and then Android, and now you've got two dominant players fighting to control the market, and everybody's starting to use the internet on their mobile phones, and everyone's starting to get in well-off economies, starting to get phones that can do that for them.
Very, very interesting space at the minute when you think about browsing and when you think about the different things that telephones can do. Well, this week, not only are we looking at some of the telecom space, but we're looking at the politics of social media. What role should the UK government have in regulating our access to services like Facebook, BlackBerry Messenger, and Twitter? This week, Number 10 Downing Street suggested that they were considering the conditional power to cut off these services in case of riot and insurgents. We're joined later by technology commentator Jeff Jarvis to debate the implications of such a move. We're also talking about search giant Google's latest business decision, the purchase of Motorola Mobility, the company's mobile arm. This graduates the software developer into the commercial hardware scene, but have they gone too far? And finally, the election promise that every home in the UK will have super-fast broadband has inched a step closer this week as Culture Secretary Jeremy Hunt announced a package that will roll out high-speed broadband for rural and out-of-reach communities. We'll find out the details. Keep listening to the next 30 minutes of Tech Weekly from The Guardian. First in this week's news, Google announced on Monday that it had acquired Motorola Mobility, Motorola's mobile phone manufacturing arm, for $40 per share or $12.5 billion, a premium of 63% on the closing price on Friday. The move by the Silicon Valley-based software developer indicates its continued proactive acquisition strategy, but it signals a shift in the attention to the consumer hardware side. Joining us on the line is Stas Espialinis from unwiredview.com, who wrote a blog post that predicted this deal. Stasis, why were you so prescient?
Well, actually, I noticed some interesting comments by Motorola's CEO, Sanjay Jha, at the end of June in an interview with Fortune. He mentioned that Motorola is open for the acquisition. And then a month later, he, during the conference calls, Motorola CEO started hinting that they might actually are thinking about demanding licensing fees from other Android licensees. And I think that was the negotiating tactics by Motorola to get a better price and to make Google buy them. And they succeeded in that. So, and buying Motorola will help them in this field a lot.
Indeed, Motorola are already an Android mobile operating system platform partner. And Juliet, they have a healthy portfolio of patents, as Stas has just suggested. Is this why Google have made the investment?
There are two reasons. That's the first one. 17,000 patents, 7,500 pending. I think some analysts estimate that of the $12.5 billion purchase price, probably $6 billion of that can be accounted for by the patents. But actually, Google got a better deal than rivals. There is an arms race for patent ownership in the mobile space. Apple, Oracle, Microsoft have all been buying patents. They spent $4.5 billion on 6,000 Nortel patents, which means that they probably paid more in the end than Google did for Motorola's. But there is another reason.
I was going to ask. Yes, you said that you tantalizingly said that there were two reasons.
I think the second cynics are saying that Google will sell on the hardware manufacturing business of Motorola and just keep the intellectual property patents. I don't think this is the case. I think that Google wants Motorola because its phones, the phones that run on Android, don't work as well as Apple's phones. And customers are beginning to cotton on to that. And the reason they don't work as well is not because Android is a bad platform. It's because Google has no control over updates to these phones. So it relies on the mobile phone carriers or the handset makers to send updates to the phones so that whatever you want to do on them works, whether it's a phone that's 6 months old or 2 years old. And at the moment, a lot of people visiting the Android Market apps store to download a Google Maps or whatever are finding that not all apps work on all phones.
So, Stasis, what will happen to Motorola? Will they be sold off? Will the hardware bit be sold off, do you think, as Julia is suggesting? Well, or do you think that, in fact, this is going to be a different direction for Google?
I don't see any reason for Google to get into hardware manufacturing business themselves and compete with Samsung, HTC and others, because, well, that's not the Google's goal. I mean, there is no way Google will be able to achieve the mobile device sales volumes only with Motorola. I mean, right now Android phones are worse than Apple. It's not because Google cannot do hardware. It's because they are worse at consumer-facing software. And they had their Nexus phones, which they controlled all the hardware aspects of the phone, and they're still worse than Apple's iPhone experience. So I just don't see the reason for them or to really start compete with Samsung. They have Motorola now, and they have can push Samsung and HTC to make better phones or maybe more compliant phones, more compatible phones or something.
Julia, what do you feel that the relationship will be now between the hardware manufacturers, given that, you know, this appears to make Motorola the preferred platform for Android users?
I think it's a huge gamble for Google. I mean, they can either have a crack and succeed at making a phone as good as Apple's, but if they do that, they may lose the other platforms in the process.
How do you feel the developers are going to respond to this? Will they back out, or do you think that they're going to remain platform faithful, that they'll stick with the Android operating system?
I think it gives Microsoft an opportunity now with Nokia. If HTC and Samsung do hedge their bets and either leave Android or adopt another operating platform, That's likely to be Microsoft's operating platform.
What do you think, Stasis, will happen with the other operators? I mean, Microsoft is already being sued. Motorola is already being sued by Microsoft. Does this now create even more of a clash between Microsoft and Google?
Well, I don't think it will create more of a clash. I mean, the other vendors, they actually will be looking at Windows phones. Maybe they now, but they are already were looking at Windows phones. The only exclusive Android, lender was Motorola, and Google bought them. Both Samsung, HTC, LG, all of them have already tried Windows phone.
Well, thank you very much, Stasis Bielinets, and read up on more mobile news at guardian.co.uk/technology. The UK government has struggled with trying to unpick the civil unrest that rocked many of the major cities over the past few weeks in this country. In addition to looking for reasons why riots broke out in London, Birmingham, Manchester, and other locations, they're also seeking ways to curtail such events from occurring again. One of the key areas that they're focusing on is the communication technologies allegedly used by rioters to organize themselves. Like similar incidents in places around the world, fingers are now being pointed at social media's role in fostering connections that galvanized into street action. And the government has been under pressure to figure out what to do about it. In a speech last week, Prime Minister David Cameron suggested that Facebook, Twitter, and BlackBerry's Research in Motion hold responsibility for some of the activities. Juliet, what did he propose should be done?
He's asked the Home Secretary, Theresa May, to talk to Twitter, Facebook, and Research in Motion, RIM, BlackBerry Maker, to come up with, I guess, a protocol for how messages that appear to be inciting violence could be managed at a crisis point. In the moment, during a riot, were any more to happen.
Joining us on the line from New York is Jeff Jarvis, author of Public Parts, who has been critical of the government's indications towards regulation. Jeff, welcome to the podcast. Thank you very much for joining. So, Jeff, what is the problem with this? What precedents does this kind of regulation potentially set?
All kinds of problems. I think that it puts the UK in the league of Saudi Arabia, which wants to control BlackBerry messages, and China, which wants to control communication and cuts off Twitter. Whether you do it temporarily or permanently, it still means that we're not free. And I know Louise Mensch, the Member of Parliament, has argued that this is no different from cutting off a road, but it certainly is. No one would suggest that the Guardian's presses should be shut off because the Guardian says nasty things that incite people. And these tools are our presses.
It's not just
a communications tool. It's more than that. And so it's a matter of free speech. And I'm, you know, very disturbed that this could even be considered in the UK of all countries.
What's interesting, you mentioned the UK of all countries, is that from the conversations that I've been having on a global scale, the UK is really viewed as a leader in terms of progressive thoughts when it comes to tackling issues of regulation, thinking most recently about the situations with Twitter and the injunctions, or even looking at, you know, some of the questions about intellectual property with government commissioned reports like the Hargreaves report. So do you feel, Jeff, that this is part of this kind of zeitgeist at the minute in the UK government, that it feels that it needs to act, that it needs to focus on this area?
Well, there is a regulatory reflex in the UK, and that's part of the discussion about the phone hacking scandal, of course, is considering regulating the press. That's anathema to me as an American with the First Amendment. But I think that, there is that consideration. And I even would tie into this Cameron's further remarks about giving police the freedom to forbid face coverings. And what's interesting about that is there's a huge discussion going on online right now about Google Plus and its real names policy. And we could discuss that for a very long time. But what Cameron has basically said is that one, in those circumstances, anonymity in public would be forbidden. And I don't necessarily disagree with that. Ian Katz from The Guardian and I had a Twitter discussion back and forth. And when one does public things in public and they're against the law, being able to apprehend you as a result, you know, makes sense in a civil society. But we also have to ask, in both of these cases, what the principles are that are at work. So you carry this over to the online world. If you can't be anonymous in public on the streets of Hackney, can you be anonymous online in public on the streets of Twitter? Just asking the question. I'm not sure what the answer is. Similarly, for the notion of cutting off communications lines, well, if you cut off Twitter, you're cutting off the press. I think we have to look at this, I'm saying, in the context of larger principles.
Now,
and as an American, I'll you know, call on the First Amendment, and you're not so lucky to have one of those, but I think that that's the level we have to be discussing this at.
You mentioned the First Amendment, but this kind of activity is happening in the U.S. as well. Recently, San Francisco's officials recently tried to cut cell phone coverage to thwart potential protesters. How has that been allowed in a country that holds free speech at such a, you know, such an elevated stature?
Amen. And many people here are appalled by this. And again, it's arguing that these tools are just merely communications tools, and that, you know, they own the tower, they have the right. If you instead say that these tools are the press, then there's a different matter. But there's also another practical discussion there, is that I think there's a demonization of technology that's going on right now, that we're trying to blame the riots on BlackBerry messaging or on Twitter and such. And in the U.S., the fear that a demonstration could be organized this way. Well, yeah, we have a right to organize demonstrations and use these tools as such. The further practical consideration is, not only could the tools be used to call to arms, metaphorically speaking, demonstrators, but it could also be used if someone's hurt and needs to call a doctor. And by cutting off the telephone lines to be able to communicate in that way, you're cutting off both the good and the bad. And so when you see something that is bad happening on a network, like organizing a riot on BlackBerry messages, if you take the stroke of trying to cut it off as a result, you're cutting off too much. It's too broad, and you're cutting off the good things that can happen as well.
Juliet,
Yes, 2 points. Absolutely, must whatever regulators introduce must ensure that people can still call the emergency services. We found during the London bombings on 7/7 that people weren't able to contact friends and family to find out if they were safe because the network had been shut down by the police. And there are reports that the network in Peckham was shut down on Monday night from people who were on the ground there. The police haven't confirmed that. What struck me was that it didn't come out that the police had shut down officially. It didn't come out that the police had shut down the London networks until the inquiry into the bombings last year. There was no official pronouncement from that beforehand from the police. And I think certainly if the police have these powers, there needs to be much better disclosure about when they're used, much more soon after the event. And secondly, I was at the Vodafone annual general meeting a couple of weeks ago where they came under fire about their behaviour in Egypt, where they'd not only allowed their network to be shut down for 24 hours, but sent out pro-government text messages. And there were calls from campaigners for digital freedom for all mobile phone carriers to draw up proper policy guidelines about how their networks can be interfered with by the authorities and under what condition. And I think perhaps the UK can take a bit of a lead on this. It's seen as it may not have a First Amendment, but it's seen as a good light touch regulator.
Jeff, this idea of the responsibility of the company, the country, and indeed the consumer seems to be seems to permeate not just the proposed regulations that Juliet is talking about, but even these ideas of public and anonymity. Whose responsibility is it to create the norms and to create the systems of regulation, whether they're formalized or non-formalized? Out of these three, who should take the lead?
That's a magnificent question, and I think the answer is none of the above, and instead us. Not to plug my book, but in public parts at the end, I come to a rousing discussion of the need to have a discussion about principles that govern these norms and govern what we expect, so that when a Vodafone cuts off access to people, we, the people of the Internet, can point to principles and say, you violated that, and give them, frankly, cover so that they can not follow the orders of a Mubarak. And when phone companies in San Francisco cut off the phones, we can have something to point to. When the Prime Minister of the United Kingdom suggests things such as he has suggested, we have principles to point to. And I think that we, the people of the Internet, separate from government, separate from companies, need to take responsibility to do this. And the problem is that the public Internet is not public. It is run by private organizations. And unless we find the ways to protect our precious new tools of publicness, we could lose them. We could very well lose them.
Thank you, Jeff, for joining us. And you can read more on this story as well as Jeff's commentary at guardian.co.uk/technology. Finally, in the news this week, the government and BT have announced their rollout plans for high-speed broadband access to rural and hard-to-reach communities around the UK. Earlier, I spoke with Bill Murphy, MD for Next Generation Access for BT, about their plans. I began by asking what BT will deliver.
We've already started to invest £2.5 billion of money, largest capital program we've ever undertaken, to deliver super-fast broadband to about two-thirds of the country. And that's a mix of technologies, fiber to the cabinet, which is 40 meg download and 10 megabit upload, and fiber to the prem, which is 100 meg download and 20 megs upload. And that's what we're starting to deliver. We've passed 5.3 million premises approximately, and we're reaching about 80,000 premises a week right now.
Why do you think that is? Why do you think there's such an upsurge?
Well, there is a need for speed. I mean, there's no question heavy users of the Internet want a better experience and want higher speeds. I mean, we're well served here in the UK. 20 million people access the Internet, use broadband today and access the Internet. And it still is growing about 20,000-25,000 a week. But, you know, businesses in particular are looking for higher speed services. And also those families that have multiple users who are maybe doing gaming and using broadband for entertainment, as well as maybe working from home. So there's definitely a need for speed.
And what is the proportion going into the major cities versus going into small towns and villages and other communities?
Well, what we said is we will do two-thirds of the country. So approximately 66% of premises will be done. But there is a challenge in rural areas where the case for private sector investment isn't very good. So today's announcement where the government has, in effect, handing out £530 million of investment to be given to counties, to Wales, to Scotland, to invest in what's being called the final third is very, very good news because that will help us to extend that commitment of 66% to closer to 90%.
And so you will be applying for government funds to reach the rural areas?
Yes, we will. We'll be tendering. We've already been successful in Northern Ireland and in Cornwall. They were ahead of the process. So Northern Ireland is just about complete. The 88% of all premises in Northern Ireland can get access to superfast broadband. It's having a huge impact on both citizens and business there.
Now, I understand that you are not going to be connecting up current non-BT customers to the fiber network. What is that going to mean for the standardized quality of a national network in the future?
Well, I don't know where you're hearing that, because our network is what we call carrier or service provider agnostic. And in other words, our networks are used by the majority of ISPs and communications companies already in the UK. Most ISPs use our underlying infrastructure from our OpenReach division.
Do you feel, finally, that the amount that the government has put aside to supply the rural areas, the $530 million, is enough?
Well, the government's also asked each area to match their funding. So if, in fact, they dole out £530 million, as they have today, that will be equally matched by counties and states. So the 530 becomes a billion. And then with private sector investment from BT, that money will go up even further. So I think, you know, the challenge of getting to 90% can be certainly be achieved with those funding levels. And, you know, I really do believe we can create the best superfast broadband infrastructure by 2015, which is the stated ambition of a country.
Bill Murphy from BT. Juliet, are BT's plans realistic?
Some people say they're not. Bill was explaining that the government money will be trebled in effect. BT will match it and the councils will match it. They'll get some European money. And that could add up to about 2.5 billion. So as much as they're spending on the first two thirds will be spent on the last third of reaching UK premises. But some people think that they'll only get, say, 75% of homes with a fibre network. The government wants 90%, with the rest done by a mix of technologies like mobile phone masts, satellite communication. So some people think it'll be 75%. It'll be in a village, the school, the library, but it won't go out to the little cottages on the outskirts.
And in terms of the relationship between BT and the other providers and the other networks that are out there, they don't have a stated goal that they will connect all of these homes. I mean, obviously, it's in partnership. It's a free market. There are other hardware manufacturers who are delivering this. What then is the relationship? How then will the network work? Will it be a standardized platform? I mean, Bill suggests that anybody will be able to have access. But what about, say, Virgin Media decides that it doesn't want to provide BT ISP? Will its customers, its hardware, its line customers not then be able to access?
At the moment, you've got fibre supplied by Virgin and fibre supplied by BT, and then some local companies, often started by local councils, trying to build their own fibre. So that's ownership of the actual infrastructure. It's a mix. BT dominates. Virgin has half the number of homes. BT reaches every home because it runs phones to every home, so potentially can do the same with broadband. BT has an obligation to share its network with everybody at the same prices it sells to its own consumer-facing arm. So if you buy your broadband from BT, BT will charge itself the same price as it charged Sky, Virgin, anybody. Virgin doesn't have that obligation because it's a smaller player and it's not a form of a monopoly. Now, the trouble for... And Virgin's OK because it has half of homes. But in South Yorkshire, you've got a bunch of councils that got together and they spent £90 million getting fibre to 80% of premises. And they've got almost... I mean, they've just built the network, but the signs are not good. None of the Skys, the TalkTalks, are coming onto the network to market the service to customers. And part of the reason for that is these large broadband suppliers don't like dealing with a whole bunch of different network operators. They just want to deal with BT, it's simpler. But also BT's charging quite high prices to connect the phone lines of any potential customers for Yorkshire's fibre network, for South Yorkshire's fibre network. And so what you've got is a big debate about whether anyone in these remote rural cottages that might not be reached by government money can build their own network in a way that will allow the owners of that small network to charge sensible prices to users, or whether BT will just force them out of business.
So at the moment, you've got, what you're saying is you've got a network that actually can't be connected to broadband. It can't actually be connected to these services.
As far as consumers are concerned. So in South Yorkshire, they're actually considering just selling their fibre to council premises and businesses, because they just can't get a consumer package
and then
out at the right price.
And then in comes the national brands that simply make it easier for other people.
Well, leaving the way for BT to build its own network in the area. So you'll just have duplication.
Well, thanks very much, Juliet and Bill. You can find out more on the site at guardian.co.uk/techweekly. And also, while you're there, we've got some open slots left for sponsoring Tech Weekly. So do get in touch at techweekly@guardian.co.uk. The football season has started, and along with the matches comes the upsurge in associated merchandising. One of the biggest cash cows in the solar system of FIFA is the FIFA brand of computer games. Now, they've been around for as long as I can remember, which is a good long time. So what's new? So much has changed over the last decade in terms of platforms and access. It's no longer just about the PlayStation anymore. Consoles now have to contend with social networks and browser-based systems, platforms, your mobile phones. So do EA Sports, who are the people who own the FIFA brand, want to take a series that ain't broke and fiddle with it? Keith Stewart spoke with Andrew Wilson, the senior VP of worldwide development at EA Sports, at the Develop Conference last month in Brighton. And he began by asking how they've been developing the FIFA brand.
In any given year, we probably have 40 or 50 million people interact with the FIFA experience. And that's purely as a result of what we've done with FIFA Superstars on Facebook, what we've done with free-to-play in Asia, what we do with, iPhone and Android and, iPad. And it's really brought in a whole range of new gamers who want to be part of that world, but maybe don't have the time or the inclination to play on console.
Yeah. And you mentioned in your talk about Netflix and Amazon, which are two big retailers that have disrupted their industries in very important ways. Can you just explain what the important things that Netflix and Amazon have done and how that relates to games?
Yeah, so I think Netflix is a great example. What they did was they disrupted based on the consumer experience, and they disrupted with a business model. So what they said first is, we are going to send discs to your house. You no longer have to go to Blockbuster. And that in and of itself was revolutionary. But the true change that they drove was they switched out the business model. To that time, Blockbuster had made significant revenue every year on late fees. And, that was a Blockbuster, treasure trove. And the reality, what Netflix did is says no late fees. And by doing that, they put the power back in the hands of the consumer. And they said, you watch what you want to watch, when you want to watch it. We're going to give you all you can eat for a set fee, no late fees. And so while they had convenience, they also changed the business model that put the control in the hands of the consumer. And that's what gave them their edge.
Yeah. So the interesting thing you said during your speech, one of the interesting things was you said maybe the future for EA Sports isn't going to be about someone paying £50 for FIFA and only playing FIFA. There could be a model in the future where someone pays a certain amount of money and gets access to all the EA Sports games, the American football game, the golf game. They pay a certain amount and be able to download all of those. Is that where you think things are heading?
I look at other industries. I look at what's happened with music, I look at what's happened with movies and television, I look at what's happened with books, and the reality is consumers have driven every entertainment industry in that direction. So the belief that we will not go there, I think, would be naive on our part. So what we're doing is preparing for a time where the consumer gets there and make sure that we're ready to be there with them open arms and welcome them into a social ecosystem that features everything we make. 10 years ago, the only way you could play FIFA was if you bought a console and a $60 disc. today you can interact with FIFA. You know, if you live in Korea, you can play it for free with microtransactions. If you live in the US or Europe, you can play it on console. You can play it on, you know, Facebook for free with microtransactions. You can play on PC, you can play on iPhone, tablet. So what we've continued to do is say, listen, we get that the console construct is not for everybody. And we're going to evolve the business model to continually provide experiences that are relevant to people where they are at all times.
So far, cross-platform gaming has been about the FIFA, let's take FIFA, FIFA being on your phone, FIFA being on your console, but there hasn't been that connectivity between them. At E3 this year, it seemed the theme was very much, you'll be able to play on your console, someone else comes in and says, I want the TV, you'll be able to transfer that game seamlessly to a mobile device, continue your game there. That seems to be where game is going. So it's not just being able to play the same game on multiple platforms, but it's actually to be able to continue your match, I guess. So, you know, if you're 1-0 down, you've got to get off your console, you should be able to pick it up on your phone and keep that game going. Do you think that is realistically where we're going with cross-platform games?
You know, I think cross-platform's a couple of things. I think there's an element of, doing what you just said, playing on one and moving across to another. And I think there are certain pieces of hardware that are going to facilitate that better than others. You know, the opportunity to play a PS3 game on your iPhone, I think, is challenging. Not because of the power that I think iPhones would ultimately have, but because of the size of the screen. So I think the true cross-platform experience is going to be about how do you best utilize a piece of hardware within a broader creative experience to deliver value without simply just, you know, porting one to the other. So there'll be opportunities for direct interaction, and I think there'll be opportunities for indirect interaction. I think it really comes down to what the hardware can facilitate and what makes the most sense.
You're competing against Activision in the core gaming market, but you're also competing against Zynga. And this is a battle that I don't think any of the other mainstream publishers have taken on. Activision, I don't see being that active in social games or casual games. It's really EA. Is this a fight that EA can take on multiple fronts? Do you look at Zynga and Activision and think you have the resources to take on these two sort of behemoths at the same time?
You know, I actually don't see it as a fight on multiple fronts. I see it as a strategy that we have to deliver consumer-driven live experiences. The reality is, gamers play across multiple platforms, and for us to focus on one and not the other would be a failure of epic proportions. And so the reality is, I think it's our greatest strength that we have the ability to deliver experiences across platforms, not a weakness or a fight that we have.
Okay, and what do you see as the, you talked about the necessity of staying ahead of the creative destruction and that there's always a new business model around the corner. Where are you looking? What do you think is going to be the next big disruptive thing that's coming in?
As our smartphones gain greater and greater power, I think we're going to be able to facilitate, you know, unbelievable game experiences there that in the past were relegated to very simple ones. I think when we think about televisions with, you know, high-end PC chipsets, I think that changes the landscape significantly. I think our friends at Sony and Microsoft are already thinking about how do they use their technology to deliver ubiquitous game experiences. And so the driver here is really going to be the consumer.
Andrew Wilson, Senior VP of Worldwide Development at EA Sports, speaking with Keith Stewart at Develop. And you can find out more at guardian.co.uk/games. That's it for Tech Weekly this week. Many thanks to Juliet Garside for joining me in the studio, and Jeff Jarvis, Stasis Bielinis, and Bill Murphy for joining me down the line. Next week, we're finding out what the Chinese tweet about. The producer this week was Scott Colley, and I'm Alex Kratosky. Join me next Tuesday for Tech Weekly from The Guardian.
For more great downloads, go to guardian.co.uk/audio.